This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello, and welcome to the dimly lit back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Hi, Scott.
Hello, Jenny. How are you today?
I'm great. How about you?
I'm in a very October mood.
Ugh, so it's wonderful.
Be
it's
prepared.
October.
That's why the corner's dimly lit. It's not for romance, but I don't know if either of you have romance books to talk about. But I've brought October with me. So.
Oh, good. Well, let's introduce our guest who's joining us. This is Jason Roland.
Hello, Jason.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Jenny. Hi, Scott.
Jason, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, either just about you or what you like to read?
Well, I can do either or both. I've been reading a long time since I was a little person, of course. Came up through the picture books and little middle grade chapter books, YA, and then discovered Southern fiction and literary fiction and short story collections. And it just kind of took off and snowballed from there. And when I'm not doing that, I do a lot of organic gardening. And that's kind of what I do, is do that. And lots of okra and tomatoes and things such as that. And just do all kinds of stuff. That's kind of my thing there, reading and gardening.
Oh, that's great.
Sounds
And that's actually...
Excellent.
The Southern literature thing is why I know you, is because
that's
we're
right.
We in the same on, book in Goodreads, or same group in Goodreads.
That's right, on the Southern Literary Trail. That's how we met on there, and talking about books, and I'm big into Southern literature. That's literary fiction, short story collections, and Southern fiction. Those are my things right
that's
there
nice.
As far as books go.
And, does that group still exist?
Oh, yeah.
It's called On the Southern Trail. Say that again.
On the Southern Literary Trail.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah, and they read two books a month, just about, usually one that's before 1984 and one that's after.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice wide breadth of Southern literature. I've sometimes read along. I don't always get there, but I've been reading a lot of authors I hadn't read before.
Yeah, and I think they started that moderator's choice now, too. So you got a bunch of, if you don't like the two they picked out, you can go with that one or none at all.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great readers in that group.
There are.
That's cool.
So glad you could come and join us.
Yes, welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah,
welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, we drew straws, and I got the short one, I guess.
Yeah, so what book are you going to tell us about?
I'm going to talk about one that's one of my personal favorite books of all time. It's called The Reapers Are the Angels. Have either of you heard of this one?
Mm-mm.
Okay. No. It's written by Alden Bell, which is a pen name for a fellow named Joshua Gaylord. When I first came across this book on the cover, this is the blurb on the cover. Alden Bell provides an astonishing twist on the Southern Gothic, like Flannery O'Connor with zombies. So how could I resist reading this book? Flannery O'Connor, zombies, okay, sign me up. What really surprised me, though, was the sheer quality of this book. I honestly believe that this is a literary zombie novel. And, I don't say that lightly. I really think that this fella has really nailed this one. What is so engaging to me about it is the main character. Her name is Temple. She's a young girl. I don't recall exactly her age. I'm actually reading it again right now. I'm not quite finished. But she's in her teens. And she has known nothing but a zombie world. So to her, this is normal. And it's her way of looking at the world, which I just find just fascinating. So I'd like to read you just the opening of the book.
Please.
And then one other section. And then you can tell me if it's Southern at all. But Southern Gothic, the author says that it's Southern Gothic is the genre that he was writing. So it's in the Southern Gothic tradition is how he put it. Okay, so here's the opening. God is a slick God. Temple knows. She knows because all the crackerjack miracles still to be seen on this ruined globe. Like those fish all disco-lit in the shallows. That was something, a marvel with no compare that she's been witness to. It was deep night when she saw it, but the moon was so bright it cast hard shadows everywhere on the island. So bright it was almost brighter than daytime, because she could see things clearer, as if the sun were criminal to the truth, as if her eyes were eyes of night. She left the lighthouse and went down to the beach to look at the moon pure and straight, and she stood in the shallows and let her feet sink into the sand as the patter waves tickled her ankles. And that's when she saw it, a school of tiny fish all darting around like marbles in a chalk circle, and they were lit up electric, mostly silver, but some gold and pink too. They came and danced around her ankles, and she could feel the little electric fish bodies, and it was like she was standing under the moon and in the moon at the same time. And that was something she hadn't seen before. A decade and a half, thereabouts, roaming the planet Earth, and she's never seen that before. And you could say the world has gone to black damnation, and you could say the children of Cain are holding sway over the good and the righteous, but here's what Temple knows. She knows that whatever the hell the world went to, and whatever evil she's perpetrated her own self, and whatever series of cursed misfortunes brought her down here to this island to be harbored away from the order of mankind, well, all those things are what put her there that night to stand amid the daylight moon and the miracle of the fish, which she wouldn't have got to see otherwise. See, God is a slick God. He makes it so you don't miss out on nothing you're supposed to witness firsthand. And that's the opening. So she's 15. A decade and a half, it says in the opening. So she's 15. And the book, you know, it does have some difficult zombie stuff in it. You know, where, you know, right after this scene, a zombie washes up on her little place that she's found to hide out. And she decides that she needs to leave because she knows that'll be the first of many. So she's in Florida at this time, and then she travels north into the South, ends up in Georgia, and, you know, meets a lot of people along the way. The main story is about her and someone who's chasing her, and I won't add more to that, but the person who's chasing her is named Moses Todd, and he is also fascinating. So I wanted to read just one more little part here because it's a paragraph or a thing that I found that kind of encapsulates the book to me. So here goes. It's real short. She says, what I mean is I done some things I don't care to talk about. Little sister, anyone alive has a collection of those things. Maybe so, but it's one thing to feel like there's a few rotten things knocking around inside you like some beans in a can. But it's another thing to feel like those things are what your heart and stomach and brain are built out of. She shakes it off and sits up straighter and crosses her arms across her chest. It don't matter, she says. It just comes from thinking too much. That's why you can't slow down for long. You got to keep your brain tired out so you don't start searching for things to dwell on. See, you'd almost have to say it in a Southern accent. I mean, I could feel myself slipping into it. But anyway. Yeah, and she also says, staying alive ain't the hard part. The problem is staying right.
So is this part of a series?
No, well, there is a second book that came out, but that book came out only in England. He's not an English writer. He's American. So I'm not sure what's occurred, if this book didn't, you know, sell a whole bunch or what, but there's one called Exit Kingdom, which I have, but I will read soon. But I had to get it from England. But anyway, I can't say enough. I think it's a 5-star novel. I really do. And I wrote the author a couple of days ago because he, on the Macmillan site way back when, like in 2010 or so, he had a thing on the Macmillan site that cited some literary influences on this book. and they took it off. So I wrote him, and he happily sent it to me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he said, even though it is without question a zombie novel, Reapers traces the source of its literary infection back to the Southern Gothic tradition and the classic stories of the American frontier. So he cites The Sound and the Fury, which he says the unquestionable master of Southern Gothic is William Faulkner. And Huckleberry Finn, he gave, there's a name, Sarah Mary Williams, in from Huck Finn. Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. He says, for my money, this is one of the great American books of the second half of the 20th century. There's one called Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
And then Winter's Bone by David Woodrell and Smonk mm-hmm. by Tom Franklin. No, I mm-hmm. saw the movie Winter's Bone, but I have not read it. Are these all Southern books?
Yeah.
Except for Mark Twain? Well, I guess he's Southern.
Midwest Southern, I guess.
Yeah.
They're all Southern, or they sound Southern to me. I've read Winter's Bone. I've read Smonk by Tom Franklin. Both uh-huh. beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he says, these are two masters of the contemporary Southern Gothic genre. My character of Temple is inspired by the tough, relentless heroines of these two books. Both of these authors create teenage girls who have managed to survive in brutal surroundings, who have actually grown accustomed to violence and corruption, which is definitely where Temple is in this book. She's grown up around it. She's never seen anything different. And she's living in the world. And her attitude about the world is something that, you know, informs my life too. It's something that, you know, it would help me if I would look at things the way she did, you know, just in how she, you know, her whole outlook. It's like, hey, things are the way they are. And she doesn't dwell on that. She doesn't fight against the world. She actually says that in the book, you know, the world's not so bad if you don't fight against it, she says.
So can you tell us why are you reading it?
Because it's October, mm-hmm. you know, I get in this mood in fall. I'm not in the South. I'm in, Utah. Right now it's starting to get cold. This morning it was 38 degrees. The leaves are changing. There's just a feeling. It's my absolute favorite time of year, and it does affect how I read, and the things that I select. I like, horror fiction. I'm reading Salem's Lot right now, or actually listening to that on audio. I never let an October go by without some Bradbury. And this is a novel that, you know, as I was trying to decide, you know, last week what I'd like to talk about tonight, I was just looking through some things and I thought, you know, hey, here's a book that I'd really like to talk about because it is one of my all-time favorites.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
And that's all I've got to say about that. So if you're in the mood for something October, please try it out. I really think it's worth it.
Yeah, you know, and I think the only zombies I've been able to tolerate have been the literary zombies. So,
you know, I can't tell you a lot of other books. You know, I don't read. You know, I spent some time last week looking through some old Audible lists, and it's amazing how many zombie novels are out there.
Yeah.
And I've read very few. I've read World War Z, and mm-hmm. I read a Walking Dead novel, actually two of them. And that's about it. I can't actually think. Oh, I Am Legend is another one by Richard Matheson, which is, I think, worth reading as well. But it's not a genre that I'm interested in. You know, when I think horror, things like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and that kind of thing. Ray Bradbury, like I said, these are the books I usually turn to, but I'm not like a big zombie fiction reader.
Right.
But this one just blew me away. I just, really thought it was something else. Standout for sure.
Great.
Yeah.
Jason, what do you want to talk about today?
I did want to make a suggestion to Scott. Talking about literary zombie fiction, another one you may want to check out,
mm-hmm.
Zone 1 by Colson Whitehead. Yeah, I got the name right.
Colson Whitehead, okay. Write
Zone
that down.
1, that is a really, that was, I found that one, I most Thursdays in USA Today, they talk about books and have a little book review. And that I think that book was published about 2-3 years ago, and they had a big write up in there about it. And it, I got it and read it, and it was really good. There was very little zombie play or killing in it, and I mean, when it was very bad and violent, but mm-hmm. It had that literary kind of mindset and theme and
yeah.
sort of tone to it.
Well,
and
that's
that,
cool.
That'd be one to check out.
Okay, I wrote it down. And that, I think that's the interesting thing about zombies is it's not really the zombies that are interesting. It's the situation that the characters end up in. Because,
right.
You've destroyed the civilization. In some cases, you're going to rebuild it. In some cases, like this book, you're wandering around the landscape. This 15-year-old girl who's surviving amongst people that don't have to follow laws anymore. I mean, they're as dangerous as every zombie. And,
that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I think The Walking Dead really shows us that, there's always going to be, no matter if in life as it is now and then in an imagined zombie life, there's always going to be a man that decides to be like the governor and be a bad man and mm-hmm. fake good but be bad, or, at least fake it as long as he can. And then you're going to have men like, well, it's getting questionable whether Rick is good anymore, but
yeah.
you're always going to have people like that are good. And it's interesting to see who's going to be the bad man and who's going to be the good
yeah.
man.
Yeah, and you put the finger on it too. Perhaps the most interesting thing about these stories is it even possible to stay good?
That's right.
In that situation,
there's a very thin line to tread there. That's for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, for sure. When you're protecting other people that you care about, and that line gets very thin indeed. Yeah. So what's up for you, Jason?
On to me now. Okay. Well, Jenny told me to have two books ready, and mm-hmm. I guess I'll go with the one I want to talk about most first.
Okay.
And it is called Snow Hunters. I don't know why it's not The Snow Hunters, but it's just Snow Hunters by Paul Yoon, Y-O-O-N. It's a very short novel. It's a little tiny hardcover, and it is only 196 pages. It is one of the most beautiful and poetic novels I have ever read, and that is saying a lot for me, because I'm big literary fiction guy, as I said, and whenever I can find something that is almost poetry on every page, that's one to keep on the nightstand. And one of the best. I read it 2 or 3 months ago. It came out last year, and Paul Yoon won the 5 Under 35 award from the National Book Foundation a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, for his first short story collection, only short story collection so far, called Once the Shore. And he read, whenever they had that induction ceremony, he read a little excerpt from Snow Hunters, the novel he was working on. And from what I've read on interviews and stuff, this novel was over 400 pages whenever he wrote it or finished writing it. The first draft was 400 pages. And he
wow.
edited and just slashed and slashed and marked in the red as much as he could and got it down to this very meager little less than 200 pages. And I thought I would read, I wanted to read a little bit of the beginning, and then I wanted to read a very, very special section of it. But basically, the book is about a man named Johan. I think it's Y-A-O-H-N, some H-A-N, somewhere in there like that. But anyway, Johan is a North Korean POW in the after the Korean War, And anyway, I guess the United States soldiers, they've kind of taken a liking to him. You know, of course he's captured, but they've taken a liking to him. He learns how to fix clothing, gets very good as a tailor. And anyway, whenever it's time for the U.S. to pack up and ship on back home, instead of just, you know, leaving him there or releasing him, they ask if he would like to go somewhere else, you know, get out of the country. And he takes the opportunity, and they send him to Brazil. They already have a job set up for him with a tailor, an older tailor. And anyway, he gets there and just starts living life for once, instead of having to fight and, you know, be in the army. But anyway, I wanted to read a little bit of the beginning, and then there's a very, very special part towards the back. It's just a paragraph I wanted to read, but here's the beginning.
Okay.
That winter, during a rainfall, he arrived in Brazil. He came by sea. On the cargo ship, he was their only passenger. In the last days of the ship's journey, it had grown warm, and when he remarked that there was no snow, the crew members laughed. They had been throwing fish overboard, as they always did, for luck, and he watched as the birds twisted their bodies in the wind and dove. He had never seen the ocean before, had never journeyed so far as he had in this month alone. He was called Johan, and he was 25 years old. He was dressed in an old gray suit that was too large for him, and wore a hat with a short brim. They were not his clothes. They had been given to him at the camp, and after he had changed, the young nurse, an American, took the military shirt he had worn for all those years and folded it with care, even though it was torn and stale, no longer recognizable. The nurse had thin shoulders, he remembered, and her neck had darkened from the sun. She had been kind to him. Through all the days at the camp, there had been that, but he did not tell her so. And he said his farewells to the guards and the doctors who stood in line under the tent in that long field where the sky was always low and vast, and where there was always a wind that carried the smell of the soul and sickness and the sound of animals from a nearby farm. He was escorted into the back of a UN truck. It had snowed the night before, but the day was clear as he left. From a tower, someone waved. He shut his eyes and thought of castles. He had also been given a russet with a spare shirt and trousers. A letter confirming his residence and his employment was in his jacket pocket, tucked behind a folded handkerchief. It was close to dawn, and the ship was near land. When the rain began to fall, the rain was slow and light, and they all remained on deck. Johan felt the drops tap the brim of his hat and vanish along his shoulders. His eyes were dry and red from the wind. The night before, facing a mirror in a cabin, he had clipped his hair short, the way the nurses had often cut his hair in the camp, checking for lice. He had also shaved, unsure at first whether he remembered how, hesitating before pressing the razor against his skin. He could see now the coast. It resembled a cloud at first. Then it changed, and the line broke into segments. Then he saw the tiles of rooftops and the stone and the whitewashed walls following the slope of a tall hill. The port grew visible, then the sails and the masts of ships. He gripped the railing and followed the smoke from the steamers rising above the town. Near the peak, he could make out a church spire and higher, on the open ridge, a single large tree. Farther up the coast to the north, a plantation house stood in a long field, and further still, on a headland, a lighthouse was flashing. But and that's the beginning right there. That's just kind of how it starts out.
Wow.
Yeah, that's mesmerizing. Beautiful. Yeah, it really is.
It is. Mm-hmm. And the little part I wanted to read towards the back, that I don't know, it was just seem, you know, every once in a while in a book you can just find something that is supremely profound to you and really, really touches you deep inside somewhere where things don't get to that often. This is just three little paragraphs, and I wanted to read those real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's on so you kind of understand this, he's riding a bike through this town, and that's why it's where it is, because it sound kind of odd if you didn't know he was on a bike. So he's riding a bike right now. Back and forth he went like this, toward the settlement, the flashing lighthouse, and the northern cities, and then back toward the piers. His chin pointed up, his body stretched against the moonlight. He was smiling. He could hear the waves pushing toward the coast, and he did not want the sound to end. It seemed to him the night would go on, and it would always be dark, the town forever lit by the muted glow of electricity, that it would be a world of nights alone. He felt a lightness in his chest and breathed the cool air. He could taste it almost. It tasted old and rich, as though it had traveled a very long way to reach him, as though he could taste the years it contained. And he felt those years and the land that it had traveled across and the people it had passed. And he thought of how it entered him and how he held it now within him. He shut his eyes once more, and he thought of others and of times before this one. So that little section, that was beautiful. The whole air passing through that. Oh, man.
Yeah, that is something else.
But anyway, that was my first book. That's a special little book, and I watched Simon and Schuster published it, and they some of their books, they have YouTube videos that they publish, you know, like little Q&A sessions with the writers, and I watched that, and Mr. Yoon talked about the whole inspiration for the entire book came from some textbook he was reading that he found somewhere, and it was just a one sentence little fact that said that after the Korean War, some of the North Korean POWs defected to Brazil, and it was just that simple fact that inspired him to write an entire novel. And of course, and Mr. Yoon is Korean himself, and his grandfather was in the Korean War, and I guess that, you know, it was really personal to him, and he wrote a beautiful book about it.
Oh, that's great.
Is
this his first book?
It is his second. It's his first novel, his second book. He had a short story collection, like I was saying, that he won the 535 Award, the National Book Foundation for. And it's called Once the Shore. And his wife is Laura Vandenberg. She wrote she's written two short story collections. I also read her second one this year. It's called The Isle of Youth. And it was absolutely beautiful, too. Both husband and wife have completely different tones and writing habits, which I'm sure is a good thing. But she writes beautifully too. She's one to check out.
Oh, I love it. Well, fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that one.
Heck yeah,
got it.
All right, Jenny, what's up now?
Well, you said that the pub wasn't written or lit for romance, but I brought romance with me today.
All right, so the dim lights are working.
They're working. Mm-hmm. I just finished listening to an audiobook called "The Future for Curious People." And it's a light kind of read. It's cute. It's funny. It reminded me a lot of like something you'd see as a romantic comedy in film. So there's this concept where you can pay for envisioning sessions, and you can see the future with any person that you've met so far in your life. And it'll show you what your future together will be, but you only get a little glimpse. So one couple is breaking up because Evelyn, the woman in the couple, saw a future where they were singing happy birthday to a chihuahua and arguing about cheese. She didn't want that. She thought that wasn't enough for her. So she breaks up with her boyfriend. And then there's another couple, Godfrey and Madge, who are getting married because they've been dating for a while. But Madge isn't sure that they're meant for each other. So that's kind of how it starts. And I have a little blurb to read just as an example of the tone of it. And this is the story of what happens right before Godfrey proposes to Madge. So this is very near the beginning. Madge is so full of life, so vigorously alive, that I'm rapt every time she walks into a room or out of a building to meet me. Why were you lurking? Madge asks jokingly. You shouldn't lurk. People will think you're a serial killer. Are we going to the sushi place? It's my turn, you know. And that's how quickly it changes. Taking turns. This is my future. Life doled out simply. Madge's turn. Then my turn. Everything in this moment seems suddenly permanent. Everything in this moment is permanent. Fact. I hate sushi. Rolls too big for your mouth, but you don't dare cut them with a fork. I don't trust raw fish. Normally, I might say, I only eat sushi that's well done. Or I might say, I'm not feeling suicidal enough for sushi today. But this would encourage Madge to give me a speech on living life to the fullest. I'm never in the mood for that, much less now on the brink of emotional risk. So I think the tone of it is just fun. I laughed out, you know, a lot. And the character of Evelyn is a librarian, so I'm always partial to librarian characters. And she actually records classics for Libraries for the Blind, only she changes the endings to happy endings. So sometimes I just need something light and cute, and this one was a good one.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. That sounds good. Well, imagine an envisioning session. That's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
It furthers my distrust for sushi.
Oh, my gosh. That cracks me up.
It's all the little details, you know. I'd love to see it on film, actually. I think it'd be a great movie.
Oh, that's a good idea. Well, so, yeah. So the second one that I brought is called, it's a graphic novel. So I've got some friends like Tamahome, who's, we need to make sure we know, or he knows that we mentioned him on this podcast. He's actually been on this podcast before. He's talked to me about a lot of, graphic novels, and I've read some, you know, I read The Walking Dead. We mentioned that before and I liked it fine. But you know, I haven't read anything past the first few. The first few issues, not the first. I mean, there's tons of books out now, but I tried some and I sampled them, you know, like, there was one called Why, The Last Man or something like that. But nothing really stuck with me. The only graphic novels that I've really connected with and I really liked are Gaiman's, The Sandman ones. Mm-hmm. I haven't even read all of them, but I really love them too. But the one that I brought is Lock and Key. It's by Joe Hill. That's right. Joe Hill. And it's drawn by Gabriel Rodriguez. And one of the reasons that I love it so much is because I just absolutely love the art. It's just fantastic. The story is about this family whose father is murdered. And then they relocate to this place called Key House, which is in Lovecraft, Massachusetts. I don't know if that's a real place, but I don't know that I should live there if it was a real place. It's like a big warning sign, isn't it?
You would think.
But the house that they move into, this family house, there's something really special going on in it. And the littlest boy, I think his name is Bodie, he discovers something called the ghost door. When he walks through it, his body falls down dead, and his ghost comes out of his body, and he can zip around the house and kind of watch what's happening as a ghost. And then he has to get back in his body and get his body back through the door to get back to normal. And, you know, so that's something that's going on in this book. And they're discovering, too, there's somebody in the well outside. And that's another part of the story that I absolutely loved. So the story is, it's about, you know, one of the people that killed their father in the other house, finds them and shows up to finish the job. But of course, you know, there's other things that happen, but, like I said, I just absolutely fell in love with the story and the art.
So when you're talking about it, are you talking about the very first volume of it?
Yes, I'm talking about the very first volume of it. It's called Welcome to Lovecraft. I have Head Games, which I read and loved, and I have Crown of Shadows, which is the third one that I have not yet read. And there's actually five of them out now. Keys to the Kingdom and Clockworks are the other two. Well, there's one called Alpha and Omega, but I think that collects everything, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's the complete set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be nice to own. But yeah, I am going to keep going in it, but I loved it. And Joe Hill is somebody I like quite a bit. I read his novel, Heart-Shaped Box, and I would recommend that book. I liked it very much. There's one he wrote called Horns that I've wanted to read. Have you read that?
It is. I have. I've read it. Mm-hmm. It is very good, and they recently... is supposed to be a movie with Daniel Radcliffe, a.k.a. Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, all right.
He's going to be the main character in the Horns movie. So,
Horns, he's growing horns, right?
He's growing horns.
Did he sell his soul to the devil or something?
No, it's sort of this kind of twisted Pinocchio sort of thing to somewhat. It's kind of a devil slash Pinocchio lying horns thing, and it's really good. Everybody that he comes in contact with, just because of this new horn thing that he has, he's sort of like the devil. He's not exactly Satan, but close enough to it, and. Everybody he comes in contact with, girlfriend, stranger, mother, father, whoever, tells him all of their just absolutely dirtiest things and meanest things they've ever done. It's kind of like they sort of go into this confessional sort of thing and tell him everything. And it's so twisted and messed up, and it's so wrong, and I love it.
That's cool. I've got to say that Twisted Pinocchio is a good name for a band. So anyone listening, feel free to use it.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, Jason, what have you got next?
All right, my second one. Well, boy, we're going to continue in the tradition of the Southern Gothic genre my second one. If Jenny knows me as well as I think she does, she knew this could not happen without a Southern book coming into play. So,
I wouldn't expect any.
So I'm kind of combining two of my favorite things, deep, dark Southern fiction and short stories, with a Southern short story collection called, it's got a long title, I Hate to See That Evening Sun Go Down, by William Gay. He is my absolute most favorite writer in the world to ever live and die. He passed away about, somewhere in February of 2012, he passed away. He was in his 70s. He was a very hard man, very hard worker. He was a drywall hanger for a long time. Lived in Middle Tennessee in a little town called Hohenwald, Tennessee. And he had a big acreage there where he lived at. Lived in a little mobile home, a cabin towards the end of his life. Anyway, he wrote most of his life. He started writing when he was in his early teens and did not get his first short story published until he was 55 years old. He just kept at it and kept writing. And he and Cormac McCarthy actually knew each other. The way this story went is Mr. Gay read one of Cormac McCarthy's earliest books, probably The Orchard Keeper or something like that, Blood Meridian, somewhere in there. And Cormac McCarthy, that's whenever he lived in Tennessee. And Mr. Gay thought, well, I'm going to see if he's in the phone book. So he looks in the phone book, and sure enough, Cormac McCarthy's number's in there. And he called him, and they ended up being friends with each other for many, many years. And most of the time, Cormac would send, whenever he finished a new book, he would send it to Mr. Gay, and he would read it, look over it, proofread it, and send it back to him. And they were friends for a long time. And anyway, and you mentioned Scott. You mentioned Tom Franklin earlier, as one of the influences of that first the author of that first book you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Franklin and William Gay, they were, in fact, this book is that I'm holding, the one I'm going to talk about or am talking about, it's dedicated to Tom Franklin.
Oh, so, how about that?
Yeah.
That's cool how things are connected.
Was,
I love it.
That was very cool how you did that. But anyway, there are, let's see, I'm trying to, let me see where I'm at here. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 short stories in this collection. And they're all very – he wrote like Cormac McCarthy. I mean, there were no – he only used periods, commas, an occasional colon. That was it. I mean, he was very – just Cormac McCarthy. I mean, he followed behind him as a disciple. And anyway, I wanted to read the very beginning. Well, it's going to be about the first two pages of my favorite short story of his. And the short story is called My Hand Is Just Fine Where It Is. Mm. And anyway, I thought I would read the first page or two of that.
Yeah,
and
please
kind of get a sense for how he wrote.
Yeah.
Worrell was sitting on the stone steps drinking his third cup of morning coffee when he saw the blazer turn off into his driveway. The softwood trees were beginning to green out in a pale, transparent haze, but the hardwoods were bare yet, and he could see the red blazer flickering in and out of sight between their trunks, the bright metal of its roof flashing back the sun like a heliograph. He had seen it come 100 times before, but its appearance was still as magical as something he had conjured by sheer will. And he hoped the magic held through even such a day as this one threatened to be. He rose from the steps, and when he heard Angie downshift for the hill, he drank the last of his coffee and tossed out the dregs. He set the cup on the edge of the porch. When she parked the blazer in the yard, he was standing with his hands in his pockets. It was March, and the wind still had a bite to it around the edges, and he leaned slightly into it with his shoulders hunched. She cut the switch and got out and stood by the car. She wore dark glasses and pushed them up with a forefinger as if she'd have a better view of it. She looked at him with a sort of rueful fondness. Sorry, I get stuck on big words. I didn't know if you'd be ready to go or not, she said. Yes, you did. Well, I don't know why. I can't see why you want to come with me. I don't want to even talk about it, he said. Are you ready? She smiled. Ready as I'll ever be, she said. She slid back under the steering wheel, and he came around to the passenger door and got in. She had the motor going but was waiting for him to kiss her, and he took her into his arms and kissed her mouth hard. When he moved his face back from hers, her green eyes were open. She always looked at him as if he were the only one who had the answer to some question she had been thinking of asking. Well, she said, I won't even ask if you're glad to see me. She felt thin in his arms. He could feel the delicate bone work of her shoulder through her flesh, through the silk of the blouse she wore. She had been thin ever since he had known her, and he always tempered the strength with which he held her now. But now she seemed thinner. If he held her as tightly as he wanted, he felt he had crushed her. Yet the flesh of the face turned toward him looked new and unused, scarcely touched by the abrasions of the world or its ministrations. Where's Hollis? He had to work. They didn't want to let him take off. The son of a bitch, Worrell said. Don't say that. He offered to take off anyway and go with me. The son of a bitch, Worrell said again. He doesn't know the whole story anyway, Angie said. He just thinks it's Tess. I couldn't say the word malignant. You're the only one who knows everything. She said she loved him and he had no cause to doubt it. They were like a drug in each other's veins, a crazy bad news drug. Their hands trembled with the hypo. The needle prodded for an uncollapsed vein. The drug they used was rare and dangerous with unknown and catastrophic side effects. You couldn't buy it. It had to be stolen under cover of darkness when other folks were asleep or their attention had wandered. If he didn't call or if he made no effort to see her, she came to see about him. She always seemed a little harried, almost strong, glad to see him still there. It was as if she expected to see the house open to the winds and him gone without a trace or a word of farewell, gone to Africa to search for diamond mines or to South America to save souls. But Worrell had given up prospect and it had come to feel each soul responsible for its own salvation, and he was always there. In bed, she'd cling to him and call his name as if she were trying to call him back from the edge or something, to warn him. There had been a time when she was going to leave Hollis for him, but the violence of his own recent divorce had sobered her, given her pause. There were other lives to be considered. Hollis said in no uncertain terms that there would be a custody battle. She was not in a good position for one. Hollis was an excellent position. He was a good provider and a steady worker, and he was also faithful, or at least discreet. Angie and Worrell had started out careful and discreet, but the power of the drug had surprised them, and things had gotten out of hand. At some point, like drunken teenagers trashing a house, they had kicked down the doors and smashed the windows and sprayed their names on the walls of the 10-foot-tall graffiti. Everything fled from Worrell in the aftermath. Everything. House and car and vindictive wife. Disaffected and disgusted children fleeing at a dizzying pace like animals scuttling out of the woods from the mother of all forest fires. Little scorched and smoking Bambis and thumpers hell-bent for elsewhere. And Worrell himself seized in the soft grasp of her flesh, scarcely noticing. He studied her profile against the shifting woods of late winter sunlight, a little stunned at the price he had paid for so tenuous and a fragile portion of her life, though he never doubted she was worth it. They were driving out of Ackerman's Field and nearing Nashville when she glanced over at him. "Did you find a place yet?" she asked. Since the affair had begun, Worrell had become an addict of shading and knots, decoding her speech as if there were always hidden meanings. What she had asked could have meant, "Have you found a place for me and the kids?" Or it could have meant, "Have you found a place that we can be without your ex-wife coming and screaming at us?" But it did not mean either of those things. All it meant was, "Have you found a place?" And he discarded it. "I may move in with you and Hollis," he said. She glanced from the road to him, half a smile, half a grimace. "It's not funny," she said. "When are you going to stop treating everything as if it were a joke?" "Maybe when everything stops being a goddamn joke," he said. The last of the traffic lights had fallen away now, and she didn't need her right hand for shifting. So she reached and grasped his left, pulling it over to the console between them. Her hand uppermost, her fingers laced with his. She squeezed it hard, then just drove clasping it loosely, her fingers calm and cool against his own. There was something oddly comforting about it, and Angie seemed to feel it as well. Her climbing into the hills, or perhaps she should have downshifted, she just drove on, the transmission laboring and vibrating until they had made the grade. "If you need your hand to drive, just take it back," he said. She smiled at him, her face an enigma behind the dark glasses. "My hand is just fine where it is," she said. There you go.
Wow. So what on earth is it about Southern writers? I mean, have you ever read James Lee Burke?
James Lee Burke is something else now, I tell y'all. Mm-hmm. Those crime fiction-y sort of things. Southern writers, I don't know. You could make the case they're all crazy, but which I think Jenny and I have met enough of them that it could be true. But,
it's true.
It's no need to lie. Wow. Anyway, some Southern writers, you know, some are just special. Like I said, Mr. Gay is just special to me because he's James Franco, the actor. I'm not saying I'm the biggest fan either, but he has really gotten into Southern fiction for some reason, and he had had published something. Anyway, he discovered Mr. Gay, and James Franco is a big Cormac McCarthy fan, and I love the way James Franco talked about William Gay, and he did the thing that I got it written down. I mean, it was just so beautiful. He said, William Gay is more Cormac McCarthy than Cormac McCarthy. And it's true. It really is. I mean, William Gay, if Cormac McCarthy would have stayed in Tennessee and kept writing fiction, in, you know, Southern fiction instead of doing stuff, you know, Western such as No Country for Old Men and things such as that, I mean, you know, this is where it would have ended up. And it's just, you know, he's just a special one. There's no other like it.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, I feel like I need to read both of the books that you brought today. Yeah, very much. All right, Jenny, what's up?
Okay. Well, I feel like I'm still unwinding this next book in my head, so maybe you guys can help me. I have brought How to Be Both by Allie Smith. And the reason that I read it is that it is on the Booker shortlist. And all I really knew about it is that it had something to do with art. So I started reading it, and it's about a girl named Georgia, very current, very present day, and she has just lost her mother. She didn't lose her. Her mother died. Let's just say it that way. And
well, what do you mean by it's very present day?
Well, I mean, like, there are references to boy bands and music on the radio that right now is really popular.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Things like that. Movies, TV shows. Plus, it's written in the UK, so, you know, some of them are even more obscure to me, at least.
Right.
But it definitely puts it in a place and time. And so it's interesting because it kind of goes back and forth to some of her memories of her mom, and also with her trying to deal with the grief after her mom has died. And so she and a friend, H, lots of shortened names here, are doing a project about empathy using art. So the first half of the book ends with George sitting in front of a painting in a museum because she has followed someone who seems to have been stalking her mother, and she can't tell if it's a friend, a lover, a stalker. She's trying to figure that out when the first half ends. Okay, so then you get to the second half, and the section is called One. And there's a picture that looks like a rose, but the rosebuds are eyes. And it starts, I'll just read a little tiny bit because I want to read a longer part later. It's like a poem. Ho, this is a mighty twisting thing, vast as a fish being pulled by its mouth on a hook. If a fish could be fished through a 6-foot thick wall made of bricks, or an arrow if an arrow could fly in a leisurely curl like the coil of a snail, or a star with a tail if the star was shot. And it goes on like that for a few pages. And all of a sudden you're dumped into the world of this Renaissance painter. And the painter seems to be speaking to us from the painting on the wall. And sometimes the painter seems like a man, and sometimes the painter seems like a woman. And the painter notices George sitting there and somehow can travel with George just to the edges of the museum. And so the painter follows George and watches her watch the woman. It's bizarre. So let me read just a little tiny bit from that section, the second half. Because I know this is not hell, because I am intrigued, not hopeless, and because I'm surely put here for some good, albeit mysterious, colon. In hell there is no mystery, because in mystery there is always hope. We followed the beautiful woman until she came to the door in the house and went through it and shut it and left the boy. At this point, the painter thinks that George is a boy. Still unseen, outside, at which point he and I retired to the small wall across the thoroughfare, but still in sight of that shut door, which is where we are now. So it has this whole feeling of kind of an incantation through almost the whole second half. And I have to admit, like, I was pretty into the story about George and her mom and her family and her therapy and her friend. And all of a sudden, everything changed so much. And it took me a while to get back to it because I was kind of thrown off. Huh. Well, it turns out that half the books that were published, the art part comes first. And then you read the George story in the second half. And I guess
that's wild. So yeah. Just depending on which one you pick up.
But. Yeah. And it's not clear by the cover.
And what do you think the point is of that? What I guess I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, the
stories are interconnected. Somehow.
They are, but it's not just like they're not parallel necessarily. Mm-hmm. And which one you read first makes a big difference in the meaning of the other, because the order that you read it in would change the meaning. Because in this order, the story of the painter has something to do with the empathy project that George and her friend are working on. But if you read about the painter first, you just wonder about this mysterious person that the painter is seeing, and they want to paint.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there's a lot to think
about. Did you think it was cool? Are you positive about the book?
It
sounds like you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Partly because I was completely confused, and it took me a while to even figure out what I thought. And then the more I read about it after I'd finished it, I didn't even catch half the things that other people are talking about. And sometimes that can be obnoxious for sure, but no, this time around it just made it more interesting. And then you kind of start seeing how she really put it together. And I'm sure there are lots of things in that first section that since I read it first, I didn't connect to the second story. So I kind of need to go back and read it again.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really astounding. And so I always like to look at which other books are on the list. And I already have talked on our podcast about another book about art, The Blazing World. But if you put those two books next to each other, I would say this one's definitely doing something that hasn't been done before. And so I can definitely see why the judges, if they had to pick one, they would pick this one.
Wow.
And then There's been some criticism because The Goldfinch, which everyone has read, didn't even make the long list of the Booker. So I guess there's been a lot of books about art this past year.
Wow. Well, I mean, I just love the concept. Again, it's just like,
yeah.
So it's, we've got envisioning sessions, and we've got, what do you call this thing? I don't know. It's backwards and forwards and entwined.
Some reviewers,
that's pretty cool,
put pictures of DNA up because to them, that's what it represents. You know, how it twists around and connects again. I like that visual.
Oh, wow. That's neat. I mean, it's something that's coming to mind. Have you ever read Gene Wolfe's The Fifth Head of Cerberus? I know we've talked about Gene Wolfe before, but have you read that?
Mm-mm.
Either of you? That's like three interconnected novelettes in one book. And how they're connected is a mystery until you get them all finished and you're like thinking about it and trying to figure out, well, how are they connected? And but they are. It's kind of fun to explore it. I don't know if this is the same kind of thing, but it's still interesting, kind of just playing with the form and all that. It sounds like something I should read too.
Yeah.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah.
I've got a big stack of things to read now.
Me too.
Which I am happy about, of course. It sounds like I'm not, but I am. Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, thank you, Jason. That was a real pleasure.
Yes,
yeah,
thank you.
Absolutely. I was glad to be on it. I've been at a whole time, Jenny. I've been listening to you, but I've been looking at the 2014 long list for fiction on the National Book Awards and picking my front runner.
Yeah.
I think I'm either going to go with Marilyn Robinson's Leela or Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
Is that with reading them first or just guessing?
That is with reading both of them first. I just got Station 11. It just came out. And I read it in a very fevered rush because it was just great and Shakespearean and artsy and just awesome. And then Marilyn Robinson.
Is always good.
She's always good. She's the nicest lady. I met her one time with you're familiar with the Open Book. And she was there last year. And she was the nicest lady. And so just it's like standing in the room with a demigod. I mean, it is just you know, just amazing. And Leela is, you know, she's returning to Gilead, and it's really good.
I can't believe you read it already.
Yeah, well, I got Leela. I was able to score an advanced reader copy of it, so I did a little begging for that, but that's okay. I'm not above begging for Marilyn Robinson. So.
I have a review copy of the audio of the other one, Station 11.
Station, yeah, it's good. I really enjoyed it. She very, very talented.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.